this post-Christian world, participation in a political community involves one, whether Christian or not, in the scatological and sacramental implications of civil symbols having a truly religious content. But there is such a content, if there is such a content, has been recognized repeatedly by our national leaders since Washington. It is futile to inveigh against the fact. The participation in these symbols of the civic religion does not correspond to Christian worship, as participation in Christian sacraments would. Rather, civic symbols correlate to free civic existence, to free political life. This life is and will continue to be radically pluralistic. There is no credo, not any civic credo, not any religious credo, which is required for participation in the civil community and in its freedom. Consequently, the religious content implicit in notions of human dignity and equality before the law, in the Bill of Rights generally, is not imposed upon any citizen, nor could it be so imposed. If that content is genuinely religious, it can be affirmed only in freedom. But this is to leave the civil community suspended in midair. It has no security, no assured basis. It cannot guarantee the perseverance of that minimal civic space by which its symbols, the Bill of Rights, continue to live. This has been the case always. But only in fairly recent times has it been seen that this must be the case, that the post-Christian civil community is to survive. It is entirely proper to reject the enforcement of civic loyalty. That loyalty which can alone serve the post-Christian society cannot be correct. Unfortunately, this policy of non-enforcement can be read to imply that civic loyalty itself is as abhorrent as would be its enforcement, thus that the loyalty is not enforced because it is evil, rather than because its enforcement would be evil. Such a conclusion is fatal to free society, for the post-Christian idea of political freedom is inseparable from an implicit or explicit eschatological hope for an historical redemption. This rests in turn upon a sacramental understanding of humanity. By that I mean a humanity whose eschatological salvation is given in the world as covenant, as sacrament. That sacramental understanding lives on a religious faith. It is the sine qua non of political freedom as we understand that term. This freedom lives by the presence of justice and human dignity in the world. These in turn depend absolutely for their very possibility upon the salvific and sacramental presence of the kingdom of God in our history. When this mystery, which can be given no rational or empirical demonstration, is no longer affirmed in faith, the faith has no eschaton to seek and no salvation to hope for, except that which is available from within, from its own rationalist resources. Consequently, when faith in the real presence of the kingdom of God in this world is lost, the very meaning of future hope is changed. It is no longer the reaching out for a divine gift, but becomes a mere reliance upon technology to make the world rational and logically ordered. The mysterious presence of God to man, which is the very truth of man, is replaced by some transcendent law, which the law is then perceived to make concrete. The human subordination to autonomous reason is then instituted. The state of the law in any given society is rarely, if ever, particularly coherent. At any moment, there are elements present in the statute and case law of a nation which symbolize and tend to render a concrete and present a vision of the human which is, from the viewpoint provided by Judeo-Christian tradition, a blasphemy. Apart from the atrocities worked in recent past by the Nazi regime, it is difficult to point to concrete instances of this in a modern society, which is not at all the same as saying that there are no such instances. But the designation of any actual or proposed public act or law as unjust awaits some sort of civic consensus, and one need only read the newspapers to discover the rarity of such consensus. Divisions on such issues no longer conform even to confessional boundaries, nor to that line between atheists and believers. The dissonance appears to be intrinsic to all the usual sociological categories. Even within the question-begging grouping of liberal and conservative, every new issue discovers Or does it appear that the highly developed arts of communication have been able to contribute to the formation of a civil consent? We have become accustomed during the past 20 years to a note of stillness in our public discourse, which may be taken as despair of finding any common ground for the raised publica which our laws should create. The possibility, even the likelihood, that we have today no common civic space, no public philosophy to bear Lippmann's expression, cannot be dismissed. The threat hangs over our discussion, menacing our civilization, no less to the more familiar spectre of nuclear warfare. This threat of civil dissolution can be countered only by an increasingly explicit reliance upon and worship of the God of history, who is Moses, Amos, and Jeremiah, and Isaiah knew, and as the Christian Church is after them has taught, alone redeems our fallen history. Faith in the God of history is alive, then its symbols are alive, and viewing our world with their truth and with their reality, the reality and truth of the kingdom of God, the city of God, which is the only human truth. If these symbols live in our culture, they present to all men a free alternative to utopianism and to the extinction of human dignity and freedom in the name of historical determinism. The Judeo-Christian alternative is available to men only if it is lived. It can never be transmitted by abstraction, for it is a concrete truth, a symbol, a sacrament that is holy. Our worship is therefore no quietly, no merely passive waiting upon God. We are created in the image of God, and that image in which is our existence is dynamic, symbolic, and sacramental. It is therefore created. By our freedom, we share in the creation of historical humanity, and that coming to be which is salvation history. This freedom is totally gift, because it is gift that is refusable. We can deny our own reality and our own will. But our dignity and our freedom are inseparable. To refuse one is to refuse the other. Such refusals, when given the standing of law, are symbolic. They make present what they say. When the law subordinates human dignity to the social interest, there is immediately made concrete in history a diminishment of humanity itself, which is inconsistent with and at war with the Judeo-Christian tradition. Such inconsistencies are endemic in Western society. They cannot be entirely avoided, and they are not all of the same degree of morbidity. It is not to be expected that they will ever be present to a degree substantially less than that which now prevails. It is not upon any expectation of historical success, of definitive victory this side of the Escaton, that opposition to such legislation is based. Neither should failure here or there discourage our opposition. For that rests upon our covenant relation to the God of history. His eschatological victory over the historical evil is a present reality, the firm and only basis of our future hope. It is our duty to symbolize that hope in every respect of our lives, for it transcends all our lives and gives them their only value. We cannot but assert that value in our legislative assemblies and our political activities as elsewhere. This is inseparable from our private and public worship of God. It is this future hope which is today denied in the more or less successful attempt to subordinate the unborn and the hopelessly ill to criteria that finally deny them the protection of the law. Their lives are left to the discretion of the mother, the medical profession, the public administration, or what have you. Some rationalist and utilitarian basis is discovered for the denial of their dignity. This is empowered. The concept of the life which is unworthy of being lived has no place among the free men, as some 20 million died to discover. The issues of capital punishment and war are far more complex. Should they be defended as consistent with the Judeo-Christian tradition, it is of fundamental importance that the defense does not contain some reliance upon those same utilitarian devices which would serve the advocates of legalized therapeutic abortion and euthanasia. For the rest, the possibility of internal crime and civil warfare is not excluded even by recourse to the sort of world political community which modern technology is making more or less inevitable. Absent the silent song of the patriotism and the jingoist simplicity, which may be thought their natural correlatives, there still remains the likelihood of a forceful imposition of public or private indignity upon individuals or groups. There remains the possibility of public violence between advocates for competing and contradictory public philosophy. The problem is reducible, it would seem, to the possibility of perhaps a duty of pacifism. Is there such a possibility or such a duty open to the Judeo-Christian tradition of morality? It does not now appear that one needs two between pacifism and an abandonment of the Judeo-Christian tradition of human freedom and dignity. Perhaps it will so appear in the future. It does seem obligatory that the issue be explored. It is now time to have done. No doubt more questions are raised by these observations than are answered. This is as it should be. If the answers are, as I think to be the case, to be lived rather than merely articulated or argued for. Abstract reasoning will accomplish little. You may be more convinced of this at the moment than I might wish. If the truth that the law bears upon the holy has made some headway this afternoon, and if you are thereby encouraged in an opposition to legislative blasphemy, such as liberalized abortion, our time will not have been misspent.
Occurred to me as I heard Father Keith reading that I guess I've assumed in the 5 or 6 years that I've known him that I fancied I did know him. But thinking back, it occurred to me I think I've never heard him speak for more than 2 or 3 minutes at a time, measured largely in discussing circles and so on. And so here this, I say, is one of the chief benefits for me personally in this weekend concert, that suddenly all these little snippets of insight that I've collected from him over the years have converged into a kind of coherent picture of John Keith. I thank you for that noble statement. Personally, it's that all the presentations we've had so far this weekend have had as one of the chief commodities, not only truth, but eloquence. Well, now it's for that transition, we await your responses. I might indulge one more platitude. It would be that I've noticed too that in the discussions which have followed the presentation, that particularly the discussions have made the presentations more clear than the presentations would have gone without the discussions. And so that, you see how much we rely on your questions to somehow smoke out the salient point. Okay. Oh, well, we've got a question. Dan, I'll let you share these requests, Dan.
Simply this. Any attempt to justify abortion, at least the argument which I've read, and I spent the last 2 weeks reflecting my attempt with it, involves some assertion, some assumption regarding the humanity, the personal dignity of the fetus. So you can see this, so probably you're going on with. Now, speaking simply in terms of constitutional law, the law makes no such definition possible. We have an affirmation of human dignity in the Constitution. If you set up a definition of what is and isn't human, you are going to necessarily create a class of entities which are outlawed. That is, in the traditional sense of outlaw, they are outside the protection of the law. Now, this is not a simple logical extrapolation to absurdity. This sort of thing has happened over and over again. The question is, does Allah permit would say to set up such a definition of the human is to establish a religion. That, in some, would be my criticized answer. That, of course, is not the subject of my I'm not going to do all the problems of moral theology. I'll just be putting myself in the mind to drop them down. I have no particular objection to entering into that on some other context, but I'd like to be notified first.
Yeah, I
have
thought that
it would be important. Simply that this discussion is on the relatively restricted area of the morality of death and dying, as it appears also to be connected with the notion of legal justice. The argue for or against the justice of Anglo-American law in terms of some preconceived morality. That opens me up, no doubt, to questions all along the line of Judeo-Christian morality. I'd rather restrict myself to those questions which arise in the area of death and dying. In other words, to conjure up the problems of the birth control, if I may. Non-implantation of the fertilized ovum. On this basis, I do not think the law can speak. Certainly, I cannot. I simply refuse the advocacy of institutionalized slaughter of that concerning whose life and his human entity. There has been no legal doubt until within the past 7 years. Beyond that, insofar as the Judeo-Christian tradition is concerned, abortion is one of those things that you simply not been taught. Now, is it necessary that everything be forbidden which can be found to be part of the Judeo-Christian tradition? By no means. There are certain things all over the truth. I do not think that the church has any right to step in and say which things are to be the object of an unceasing Catholic or Protestant or Jewish advocacy or opposition. But I do think that our own worship has a prophetic element, and that prophetic element is effective in our public life. And part of our public life is to work out our own contribution to a dynamic moral tradition. Now, we have done this in many areas. We have enlarged the rights of men by public advocacy, and we have done this under the spur of moral judgment in wide areas of human conduct, particularly, of course, in the recent times, in the area of criminal justice, and of the laws which inhibit racial tendencies, if you can hear a public discussion of it. Now, I think that the Judeo-Christian morality makes incumbent upon each one of us a public life which seeks out the meaning of the worship of the God of history. And it does not rest content with a whether the fact verdict is not proven. Because one cannot prove that this or that is flatly contrary to established morality. It does not mean it is a matter of indifference. It was not provable in Jefferson's time that a slave didn't constitute 3/5 of a man. Some prophetic witness, Christian and otherwise, finally moved away from that activity. And we recognize it now as having been a necessity in the 18th century. It didn't become real until well into the 20th. I think the same burden is upon us in the areas of contraception, in the areas of abortion, and wherever we are concerned morally. But I don't think we have any business saying, on one hand, we are adult Christians, on the other hand, we're not bound to do anything
right or wrong, unless the church has already spoken in his oath. You can't have it both ways. There is a morality, a demand upon our public morality, that goes beyond anything that's commanded in common law or in the moral doctrine of the church. I think we all agree on that, but there are places where we prefer to see it abrogated and places where we don't. This is not to say that there are conclusions toward which we must inevitably go. You can't rationalize this truth. It's a religious truth, and it's pursued existentially, in the sense that it can't be your own decisions in this. You have the right to communicate. You have the right to urge them, to discuss them. But they cannot be deduced from the gospel. We do not live lives of logic. Yes, I think so. To enter into any of these discussions, actually, the kind of expertise which generally comes from someone places, you know, as you are. Obviously, not for being versed in things medical, I can only have the most vague understanding of the environment out of which the question proceeds. I would say that any hurry to decide that this person is dead, which is not in his own interest and motivated solely by his interest, is exceedingly suspect. For instance, in the sort of cases we were discussing last night, I have the impression that many physicians would be quite willing to consider a body cadaveric for purposes of organ transplant, but not for purposes of autopsy. Am I correct? Practice to their religious profession. Now,
that would mean that in those areas where the medical profession may find itself tempted in this or that fashion to subordinate a human individual to some other consideration, some utilitarian need of the community or some branch of the community or some person. I would say that the medical doctor, as a Christian, is involved in a Christian duty that does not proceed out of medical expertise, but proceeds out of a relation between his professional and his religious existence. These are the same existence. He has the correlation. No one can do it for him. And I think this is part of a prophetic role, if you like, of the medical professor. And anyone who steps into it and tries to supplant it and make it unnecessary, I think operates illegitimately. You go up back into a rationalization of morality. It cannot be done. I think this does not mean that there should not be law to safeguard the helpless, those who cannot safeguard themselves. Because the laws that we pass, which legitimate indignity, tend to create a society in which those are not conceived of as indignity. And the logical threat of that kind of law is to a simple, rationalist, utopian society, in which Aristotle says that which nature intends is the species and not the individual. I think that is the outcome of that kind of system. Christians who kept their religion private instead of making it public. John Courtney May, over a period of about 15 years, hammered out, I think, the classical solution to the interrelation of church and state. The state doesn't have any duties of worship at all. None. It's purely impersonal in this sense, in that sense. But every one of us, as citizens, are also Christians, or Jewish, or Judeo-Christians. We're within that tradition, even if we don't have an explicit religious tradition. Those of us who benefit from that tradition, we have to make it live. That is a prophetic, a messianic tradition. It has a futurist threat, an historical threat. And if you stand aside from the history, you have to be saved in it. But see, there's only one salvation, that's the story. And if you decide that it's better to come to our cabbages, that's what I think, and all. Now, a witness is a sort of famous member of the divided of late. Almost anybody who raises a sign is a witness. They're giving it. I'm talking about somebody just out there and fight in terms of political involvement. Now, one may conclude from this that I have less sympathy with the standard rather than I might, that's true. I don't require what it does. I think that one of the problems of political witness is a too ready inference that this moral decision is a deduction from the gospel, that it is therefore incumbent upon all men by logical necessity. No, it's incumbent upon all men by their Christian existence. participates then of the ineffable nature of faith. You are never going to prove that this fetus is an infant, is a human being. You start out with the prior assumption that life, human life, is holy. This is human, it's alive, it's therefore holy. You don't prove that the existence of reality is a holy. And the same for political speeches and culture. Obviously, we're just about that. I'm not talking about condemnation. In many cases, there are things that should be condemned. And if someone wishes to put his faith on the line and condemn them, that's his business. It isn't necessary, however, to universalize the judgment. Its value is not a logical universality. Its value is precisely its entry into the Christian people as an honor. And like all prophetic acts, it's judged within the community and by the community. And not by reason, not by eloquence, but by the community. Not the opportunity, the obligation.
Yeah, thank you.
Bella goes on to deduce conclusions as to what would kill civil religion in this country, which I would not necessarily accept. But I think there is, in our notion of political freedom, an eschatology which is supported by nothing imminent to society as such, but rather which is supported by Christian and Judeo-Christian witness in the broadly sense of the term. Absent that witness, that notion of freedom dies because it's specifically Judeo-Christian. You don't draw it in terms of deduction. You don't draw it by scanning some schema of what it is to be human and free and dignified. As soon as you do this, you're on the road to start a rationalist utopian political theory, which is precisely destructive of what I want to be real. But your question supposes that there's a rationalist answer and there isn't one. It also supposes that anyone who proposes that kind of an answer has to have some sort of universal confidence by which he has arranged all the topics, all the problems of human living. It seems unlikely that such a one will emerge, so there have been volunteers. The fact of your question, it seems to me that it begs a lot more serious. Point number one, I respected the argument to therapeutic approach. That is, the abortion takes place to do with concerns less than the life of the mother. It is justified by concerns less than the life of the mother. Well, the original moral teaching in this has always been presented in rather more absolute terms. In fact, the abortion which the moral theologians have generally condemned is across the board, all abortion. Now, there is some reason to believe Newman presents the evidence in the recent book he published, Abortion and Morality, in probably 1970, in other words, in the programmatic essay of the book, he suggests that there is canonical and moral justification for the exception which is universally given in the traditional law on abortion, that is, to protect the life of the mother. I'm not an expert in that area, and I would simply take that as well. He is expert in the history of moral theology. The problem then is a quality of life versus life. If I admit this, I do not see really what is the objection to the slaughter of the Jews. So I have to confuse the quality of my life, so to say. No, it can't be proven one way or the other. These are digestible, I don't know. And I don't think you can admit the principle at that point. But once you admit it, what limits you to think? Kind of a fundamental affirmation as to the relation of man to his society. Does he transcend it to the extent that he cannot be subordinated to its imminent need? Radically subordinated. He cannot be killed for the purposes of society. Now, that's a very narrow. It's a very narrow case, because it's entirely arguable that something such as capital punishment is not utilitarian in function. But if it should turn out to be utilitarian, on that basis it would be discussed. Well, I think here it would be useful, not necessarily conclusive of the discussion, but that particular kind of argument, the distinction between seasons and non-seasons, excusing cause, double effects, and so on, which is dismissed to a certain extent, is unfortunately now in the process of being reinvented. It's precisely those distinctions that which we have to deal. There is a distinction, for example, between pushing somebody in the river and once he is there, letting him drown. There are distinctions between our obligations to people, depending upon our relationship to them, whether it's some sort of fiduciary trusting relation between human beings. It's compose their duty. Let's take an example. Can be, as they say, pull the plug. Well, a great deal of that difficulty can be encountered, I think, more rationally if one first accepts the standard teaching that there is no need for massive medical intervention. They are not morally demanded, merely because they are possible. And here, not to put someone on a respirator or comparable techniques may be a part of ordinary medical practice. Now, this will depend upon the state of the art, and the conversation as to what is and isn't ordinary medical practice cannot be conducted by learning. And to an extent, then, you are relying upon the Christian witness of the medical profession in this area. They can speak honestly out of their experience with medicine. No one else can. They don't have the experience. But it is possible that an entire profession, and I'm not here thinking particularly of medicine, which is easy to point the finger at law, an entire profession can become very careless in this sort of thing. And therefore, there is a need for a lively lay interest in their conclusion. Not in the sense that one speaks up with a medical practitioner, but that one can ask an intelligent question. Thank you very much.
And I'm not afraid, even though I know I have cancer, because I really believe that I will be with him. I think that this is another example of that growth that takes place through the process of near despair that Dr. Benson spoke about. Pain beyond expression. Each one of you put yourself in that position in relation to the one whom you love most deeply. You yourself are separated in grief, anxiety, and pain. You don't know whether they're alive or dead. Not none of us here in this room hasn't experienced something that touches on that at some time or other in our lives. So we all know what we're talking about. And then she said, and because of that, I'm not afraid of it. And truly, I do think that one experience prepares us for the next. As I was leaving come back to America in May of 1968. I wanted to say goodbye to her, and I could hardly go in. And yet, I owed it to her. We loved each other, and I respected her, and I knew that, you know, I needed to leave her, and I needed to tell her I was there. And like so many times in life, our information is to slip away rather than to face it. But we don't really respect people when we treat them that way. And so I gathered up the courage to go in and say goodbye. And she said, you know, I'm so sorry that you're gone, because I had hoped that you'd be with me when the end came. And I said, I'm sorry too, Mrs. Taylor. But you know how many wonderful people are here to be with you and will be with you for certain. And I could say that with certainty, I think this will remember. And she said, do you think we'll meet again? And I said, I really do. I said, you know, this last year, they sent out a great big questionnaire from Washington, D.C. to all the sisters in the United States to find out whether or not they were renewing. I won't tell you what the answer was. I won't tell you what the survey was. And one of the questions was, how do you feel about heaven? And they gave you several things, you know, that you could answer. But this is what you thought about heaven. You know, that heaven was eternal awareness, eternal union with God. Heaven was the fulfillment of all of our natural and spiritual potential. The answers were varied. I mean, there was one that I just lost sound to, and that I've used it 100 times if I've used it once for patience. And this is the answer. Heaven is the people of God praising Him and enjoying each other. Well, that's the answer. If a person says this, just ponder all this implication. I don't know whether it was the right answer, but it's the one I said that. When she said to me, do you really think you'll meet again? I could say to her with real truth, yes, I think you will. And I said, you know, you never know how these big jets are going to turn out. So, I may get there ahead of you. But it looks like you'll beat me to heaven. But I said, Mrs. Cornell, you know, be on the watch for me. Be mindful of me when you come into God's presence. And pray for me, and pray for the work we're trying to do. And beg Him to help us really reflect His Son's love to a world that needs Him so much. And she said, I will ask Him that when I see Him. But she said, I really want to find you. It'll be like looking for a needle in a haystack among all those people. Now, what about that? I don't see anything. The whole idea of things is just as good as mine. Who can say it won't be that way? I was talking to Ian Foster in her own concept of what heaven might be like. Dr. Mighty says, believe in an ultimate purpose and meaningfulness of the universe, and in the intrinsic value of the individual human being, is seen to be the distinguishing mark of the Christian human. You know, we all know that there's a tremendous movement now for the kind of an atheistic humanism. The Secular Society of London, you know, promoting everything that's good for this life, as though there were no lives to come. And there's been kind of a misconception in Christianity, a kind of a distortion, a perversion of Christianity, which Pope John, I think, really tried to straighten out when he called the Council, which seems to indicate that because there is going to be eternal bliss hereafter, we should be willing to put up with all kinds of injustices and iniquities, in equities and iniquities, and sufferings and abuses of human rights and human freedom. I'm at a professor when I was in Dr. Harold Weiser's Neighborhood Health Center in the South Bronx at 169th and Webster in 1967. The resentment Puerto Rican part of the population. It was about 50-50, New and Puerto Rican. The reunion on the part of a slightly the more educated Negro against Christianity, because they felt that it was the faith of their friends in this new pastor that kept them from rising up in rebellion against the injustice that they had suffered for the past couple of centuries right here in our land of the free and home of the brave. And back in New York, wearing, as I was wearing in, a little gray habit, not too much different from this, with my gray on. I'm sure the only reason I invited me in the first place was because I couldn't get anybody else to be in there. It was a scary place to work. Day and night. And a lot of nurses just didn't want to work. They couldn't. They had friends. They had people coming. And when I was free, that's what the girls went to know. I hope to get the girls in here. That's what Father Dan and Joseph Morgan say is the very central witness of the soul. This freedom to be able to witness. Other people have too much at stake. You can only go so far when you have a house to pay for and six children to get through college. And then if your job depends on whether you back down or stick with the principal, you have to think of these other obligations. And I kind of like that. I like that idea. I think that's actually what I haven't thought about in relation to myself. But I think that Father Dan Berrigan has a very good point there. You know, if we're really everything we ought to be, that's celibate, that celibacy should make a difference. It should give us the added courage to stand firm to the very end. And we have to look to a very tremendous Christian who wasn't a celibate, for example, and that's St. Thomas More, than a lot of the celibates fell to the wayside. But when we went to that medical center, a lot of the educated Negroes really resented me. They resented having me there because I represented this Christianity which had submerged their people for so long. Pope John got us right up to face the fact that just because there's heaven up here doesn't mean we don't have to do everything we can to make this a good life. And we can't let people continue to feel that way about Christianity because it is a misconception. And the only way to feel it is to be first concerned about their welfare in the here and now. As a proof of our belief in their eternal joy thereafter. And if we neglect what we can do in any capacity to help them now, what we say about the future doesn't have much credibility. And that we say, that's the truth of the thing. If you believe that I am so important, that I am so valuable, that God is going to show love and light and joy on me, that he's going to bring me to that fullness of my existence, if I am so valuable as the New York Times, what about me having a roof over my head and a living wage? Yeah. Are those two related? What about my having somebody to listen to me when I'm afraid and alone? I'm not certain what tomorrow's going to bring. What if I'm wondering because I hear people whispering and I see people sticking outside and I ask big questions? And the doctor saying, I'm not denying Dr. Benson's statement. I think we can take half the blame for what's happened in relation to this. We're quick to blame the doctor. But how can I? That I'm getting weaker every day, and that I can't eat anymore. And yet, doctor says, now you should take it. We're going to get up and get out of here. We're going to get through it. What about the value of that person and their right to all the things that can be together, where their happiness and their peace and their sense of well-being right here in the very moment. You know, we can't let this warped concept of Christianity affect who may be very less guilty in here in Australia. And of course, that's what the concept is all about. But to believe in immortality doesn't mean, isn't just this pie in the sky when you don't have concept. You know, don't worry about now. Survive well, suffer through it, everything's going to be great later. That isn't what Christianity is all about. Logic and consistency bring this belief in its fullness to a host of personal immortality. Such a faith and hope in no way supports the perversion of Christian belief, which implies that man should be content with his miserable life and not strive for the human dignity and good life which are his right now. The pie in the sky when you die concept, which is rightly repudiated by many of today's young activists. Now, you know, we don't want them to repudiate the whole thing. Just because we haven't put Christianity into action the way we should have, doesn't mean that Christianity in itself isn't good. It just means that we shouldn't, the fact that we fail, we shouldn't let them throw out Christianity along with our failures. But I think the young Jesus people are going to say that for us. Only this thing, I heard this misconception, which I'm talking about, promoted by a speaker at a regional health planning conference, in reference to a population largely Spanish American and Roman Catholic. He said, and he was standing in front of a category of very sophisticated class in Howard University, in view of the prevailing religious belief in this area, that suffering and misfortune are God's will, and are to be passively accepted, it isn't easy to bring people to an interest in comprehensive testing. That's why he was spinning down Christianity. To attribute to Christian faith the sense of hopelessness to which minority people finally succumb after generations of suffering, deprivation, and lack of opportunity is a very short-sighted interpretation. But if we Christians participate in the suffering and the deprivation and the lack of opportunity for these people, then we can't complain when they put this short-sighted interpretation on how our Christianity implies. And that is both in the area of all the big social problems as well as our share of the dime. We can't have a lot of beautiful prized platitudes for the last moment unless we really try to meet the needs of this individual searching for help all through this illness. Next, we have to get into something that's very, very difficult. And that is this whole problem, as Dr. Benson mentioned this morning, and probably Dr. White mentioned last night. If there is a God, how can there be my kind of suffering? How can this happen to me? If there is a God of love and goodness in his heaven. Which thoughtful person will deny the mystery of suffering or the tragedy which befalls one in human life? Likely, there is no one in this room who has not experienced deep suffering. I was looking over the crowd last night. I told somebody at the supper table that the only place to see the pictures of young sisters now is on the Christmas catalog. Genesis and Fifth Chapter, they have lots of dancing young sisters. But I'm telling you, when you get into a crowd now, you don't see very many young sisters. And that's something for us to think about. So I'm going to say that if really young people haven't experienced deep suffering, at least most of the people in this room have lived long enough to really come up to the hub of what we're talking about when we talk about the mystery of suffering. The loss, those of you who are parents, the loss of a child to death, which brings a pain-filled sorrow to the lips of a mother or a father, and leaves it there unanswered. My secretary watched a little boy die of leukemia over about a 2-year period. It took her 2 years to recover from that suffering. You know, nobody knows but the parents who have gone through it. And I know that that question came into her mind many times as she sat at his bedside. Oh God, if you are a God, how can you let this happen? And then there are something really worse than this. You know, when you see someone whom you love deeply suffer over a prolonged period of time, you know, then you say, oh God, if you are a God, how do you take him? A different approach. And then there's something else, which is probably a single one of us who hasn't known, even if we haven't been close to hear a physical illness. And that is the deep anger when a very deep and meaningful loving relationship is tended. I have talked with people in death, a man or a woman, when he first realizes that his spouse is unfaithful. The loneliness, the love, the how can I go on that comes into a person's life, and even in other relationships, someone whom you love and trusted, and on whose integrity you would have laid down your life, will never change. Will always come through. You can count on it. If you can't count on anyone else in the world, you can count on this person. And your love for them is rooted in the same tremendous sense of such valuable in life, both spiritual and temporal. And then to wake up one morning and find that that no longer is. But that person isn't there in the same capacity. Suddenly you're dealing with a stranger. And you wonder how you can really go on. You know, is there anything alive that's worth trying to hang on to? And the movie is speaking about comprehensive health care, said, between a Christian says, these are God's gifts. We're supposed to bear them perfectly. Now, there's a difference between ill health, which something can be done about, and some of these other things. Because we can't say that these other experiences are outside the will of God, his providential love. And yet, how can we still believe in his love and goodness and believe that they're inside? I think that these answers are to be found in a way so deeply personal and intimate as to be understood only by the sufferer as he comes into God's presence and pulls out his helplessness and even his total hopelessness and there experiences the meaning of Christ's words, the gain of peace to live. It is important for those who minister to others who are suffering to realize that in this area of human experience we are dealing with mysteries. While science tests life on the reasons for human responses and predicts them in given circumstances, that component of human freedom cannot be measured and projected always with certainty. It is from this wellspring that faith and love and endurance and real heroism well up in response to the touch of the Spirit to give them the courage to go on. And it is a mystery. And no one can even tell another person about it. But I believe most deeply with Dr. Benson and with Ladislaus Boas and other profound thinkers on this subject that to not gain a seat goes through this dying process, new life does come. privilege in that career and that English account and that real darkness, as Father Robert Brown said this morning, that death not of a soul, not out of a book, not even out of St. John of the Cross, but right out of your own experience. That's what gives rise to new life and gives you a certainty about the next question. You know, when we go through these experiences in death, we think, how can I go on? How can I ever live again? But when we do start living again, we live with a new life. So we don't care so much anymore. We can see it with God's help. And you know, that is part of the process of helping the dying. And I have seen it happen. I see people go through that struggle stages of coming, of going through this dying. You know, there's an old person telling, he said this so beautifully. She wrote a little book called From Death to Life. And she's talking about all the situations in which we die along the way. And having died, live anew. Live with more of ourselves to go in there. And she speaks about the little 2-year-old who dies. When a new baby is welcomed into the family. How about that? And if the mother and the 5-year-old who dies, the first day she takes him by the hand and leaves him a headstone. He's so lonesome he can hardly stand it, and she can hardly bear living through the day without him. And the parents who both die, from that young 14-year-old, and maybe it's 12 or 13 now, goes out on a first date alone with a girl. It is a trepidation and an anxiety. And the dying of his place, he knew I would ask somebody because he couldn't hear all of her. I thought I would die, and I knew I thought I would blow my last breath the first time I was ever terribly homesick. It was awful. And those of you who have read Thomas Merton's Seven Star Mountain, remember this description of the first time he ever fell in love and was repudiated. And he said, you can never go through it the same way twice. The agony is exquisite and impossible to put into words. And maybe that's true. And then the dying when a mother of 13 years sees a son in uniform go off to Vietnam with the awful fears of all the things that are happening now besides just being caught by a lot of our Vietnam. And the death species of a father who takes the young bride up the aisle and takes this cherished, lovable little girl and turns her over to another father. Now, these really are all community growth processes. And those of us who haven't experienced one or the other can say, oh, you know, what's that got to do with them? If you've experienced it, you know what it has to do with them. And Mary Perkins Ryan says, experts agree that that enables a person, more than any other factor, to take the risk of leaving behind the self and the life he has and venture ahead is the security of a real love that recognizes and shares with him as a person. And that it's that being surrounded and supported by a caring somebody that enables people to have the courage to step out in faith and take that next step into a new life and leave the life we've known behind. And that if that's true in the natural order, and these are also spiritual things, they all have a spiritual component, then it's even more true when a person finally comes to that last moment. I know from my experience of St. Christopher's, and Dr. Sanders has written this many times in her writings, and I heard her give it in text. We would be inclined to think that the person who had a joyously fulfilled, happy life, just overflowing with meaningful relationships, would find it hardest to die and leave all that behind. And that the person who's been abused and neglected, and who's had the card struck against him, and who's had things fall apart over and over again, and who has known much more failure than success, and much more rejection than acceptance, that person would be happy to step out into death and leave it all behind. But just the reverse is true. It is really the person, and I think that Maslow, in his beautiful concept of when the loneliness is fulfilled, we can better bear having the next one unfulfilled. And the more their needs that have been fulfilled, and the more love we have known, the more willing we are to run the risk of being deprived. Yeah. Being deprived at least of that love. And you know, and I think that's true, and I believe that it's the people who are so whole because their needs have been fulfilled, and they have really experienced in-depth love and meaningful relationships, that they are able to bear running the risk, either of leaving things behind, or going without it for a while, or believing in God's faith. I read in America this year a beautiful thing, just a little line, let me explain that. And it said, faith is only, is truly faith only insofar as it is practiced. And that brings us right up to the topic that we're talking about. You know, it's easy enough to talk about it here, but it's when things are really blessed, and when we don't know where the next step is going to take us, and when we're uncertain about almost anything, just when we begin to know what faith is all about. Father Burns is giving you the house sign. So I'm going to say just, how many more words can I say, Father, before the discussion? Okay. You can ask me questions about St. Christopher's, will you? I mean, you thoughts have all come from my experience with St. Christopher's. I'll talk about the specifics when we have some questions. We do have a little time left. I think that, I'm going to close and tell them to say a few more than 13 words, but it's circumscribed. I won't go beyond this whole paper. Last October, Dr. Sanders was over, and she spoke in several different places, and we met down at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. And then, after she had fulfilled her teaching obligations, we went out to Gethsemane and had a couple of days of retreat and just prayerful reflection and sharing as we walked through that beautiful Kentucky countryside in October. And we went up into the hills put there by the monastery of Gethsemane, the Catholic monastery, and we found a beautiful sculpture which had been donated as a memorial to a young man who was killed in the March at Selma, an Episcopalian seminary. And it was graphic and beautiful. And as we sat there and looked out over the hills and saw this beautiful agony in the garden, all done so well, you could see the suffering of Christ. And you could almost experience this sense of abandonment when you looked down the road a little and saw this covered group of sleeping apostles. And the fact that he was going through a very human experience, closely associated with what we've been talking about. And suddenly, you know, we had a new insight into the real humanity of Christ and the extent to which he really suffered. What probably most of us will go through in one way or another before it's all said and done. And the support that we can find in that realization that he has gone ahead of us. And then we went down to the monastery and we prayed there, vestures with the monks. And as we went out, I picked up this little prayer of Father Norton. And it seems to so much, that's what we feel when we're going through these dying experiences in life, and what probably many of the dying feel as they come close to that last moment. It's written by Father Thomas Norton. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right way, though I may understand nothing of it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my terror alone.